Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 921. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, which will allow you to transform your brain ideas into a physically manifested web presence. Whether it's your work or selling products or a blog, any kind of services, just a few clicks. Customize everything from look and feel to settings and products. Use amazing templates created by world-class designers. And then you don't install anything. You just put it up there. You don't have to patch anything or upgrade anything ever. So head to squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code Nerdist to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. I'm going to be performing, by the way, at Helium in Portland as I'm putting together this new set for the next special, which I'll maybe tape that in like a year or so. But anyway, I'll be at Helium Portland December 7, 8, and 9. Mike Furman's coming with me, and there'll be some music and some stand-up, and it'll be fun. So just go to Helium Portland's website, buy tickets, come to that. December 7, 8, 9. Katie, what's happening in the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
We got a couple cool things today. So Greg Murray is a professional photographer in Cleveland, Ohio.
Fuck yeah, he is.
He takes pictures of dogs.
Uh-oh.
And they're amazing. He has a book out called Peanut Butter Dogs, which is just funny pictures of dogs eating peanut butter. I bought it for my nephew, and he just laughs at it nonstop. He loves it. He also just came out with his 2018 calendar featuring even more of it, adorable dogs, and all the proceeds will go to the Happy Dog Foundation. And he's available to hire to take pictures of your dog if you live in the Cleveland area. So to find out more info about how to hire Greg or where to buy the book or calendar or just to see adorable pictures, check out gmurrayphoto.com and follow him on Instagram at thegregmurray. And then also, Jason Brent writes, there's some really cool things happening in Detroit and the Detroit-ish areas coming up December 7th through 10th is the Big Time Garbage Fest, a new comedy festival organized by some of the top show producers in the area. We are so happy to have Todd Barry, Annie Lederman, and a bunch of other really cool comics there. A $50 weekend pass gets you into all three headliner shows. There's also going to be plenty of shows to see local favorites, including a showcase devoted to the women and LGBT voices in their scene. They're really excited about it, so check out BigTimeGarbageFest.com to find out more info on how to get tickets.
Thanks, Katie Levine. This episode is Seth Rogen, who is, this is a three-peat,
yeah.
Seth Rogen. Seth's great. Seth is just such a fucking cool guy. He's one of those guys, when you talk to him, you're like, thank you for being famous and being someone that I can rely on
and
to be cool.
And he's also like exactly how you think he's going to be.
He's
so
great.
Cool.
He's just such a sweet guy. He's promoting The Disaster Artist.
I'm so excited for that movie. I'm beyond excited.
Which is all about The Room. James Franco plays Tommy Wiseau. It's in theaters Friday, December 1st. Also, Preacher will be coming back on AMC. And he's also producing Future Man, which is on Hulu right now.
He's a busy guy.
He's a very busy guy. He's like a... It's really like... There are a handful of really productive stoners. You know, it's like, yeah, like weed dudes who make a lot of stuff. It's like him and Doug Benson and Kevin Smith. I'm sure there's more, but it's like, you know, there's like a whole new, it's like breaking
they're
the
giving,
old.
They're giving stoners a new name.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, yeah, you can be a stoner. You can like weed and do cool shit.
And do a lot of amazing stuff. I was never that person. The only thing I accomplished, the couple of times that I smoked weed when I was young was just sitting in a corner and thinking I should go to the hospital. That didn't really.
Yeah, don't smoke weed anymore.
Didn't really work. Don't didn't really work out for her. Lydia tried it once when she was young, and she went blind temporarily. So we're both not real good on the 420 biz. But Seth Rogen is a goddamn delight. And it's very nice for him to come back on the program. Jonah Ray sat in on this too. He's been coming around more.
Yeah.
Matt Myra's still MIA.
No, we don't know where he is.
He's on an airplane right now on his way to or from somewhere. This episode brought to you by Stamps.com. It is the holiday time.
It is. Lots of mail in the
mail. Very busy people. A lot of packages. A lot of stuff. And let's just focus on your peace of mind and convenience and happiness. Use Stamps.com. You don't need to leave your home. Bring all the services of the post office right to your fingertips. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, package, class of mail using your own computer, using your own printer. Your mail carrier is going to pick it up. Make sure to give your mail carrier a nice little extra envelope for the holidays. Yep. Take care of them. They bring your mail the time. It's not an easy job, and they just... It doesn't just appear in your box. They pick it up and they bring it to you. So Stamps.com is going to send you a digital scale. They're automatically going to calculate the exact postage you need. And they're going to help you decide the best class of mail based on your specific needs. So any time of day, Stamps.com is always open. And there's no line.
There's no line. And you're in your home already wrapping the gifts. Just put them in the box, print the stamp,
Wrap, print, mail, and then repeat. Right now, you can enjoy Stamps.com using a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Without long-term commitments, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com into the promo code Nerdist. And now, Katie Levine, as you have so many times before, please roll the thing on episode 921, Seth Rogen of the Nerdist Podcast.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, we were very uncomfortable coming in and just seeing like a bunch of suited dudes in suits.
It was really scary. It was weird. It was incredibly weird.
I just assumed like, oh, this is
James Franco.
This is James Franco.
That interview movie really had lasting effects. Yeah, no. When we're together, they have to.
Yeah.
Is he floating around somewhere else in the hotel doing the same thing? Paul Scheer's in the movie too.
Paul Scheer's in it.
Fucking love Paul Scheer.
Everybody, got them all.
Man,
it's a big cast.
When did you guys decide to? I mean, people ask me how I have time to do stuff, but then I look at you and
we're both busy.
I have the same question because I feel like you do more.
I do a lot. Yeah, I don't know. I look at you and I think that guy's doing a lot of shit also. I just work a lot constantly on – but I really like the stuff we're doing, and so it doesn't – you know, I wish we could do more, honestly. Like, there's ideas we have that we don't have enough time to do, and ideas that me and Evan wish we could write, but we're working on other things that we're writing, you know? It's nice when there's a lot of ideas around, and then you have the ability to get some of them made. We'll keep trying to do that, you know? Yeah, I mean, we enjoy it. I think that's, like, the key, is we have, like, a really good time doing it. We like the stuff that we're making, and so it doesn't feel like a chore to do as much of it as we humanly can.
You're going to be one of those Mel Brooks guys that at, like, 92 is like, I'm doing a musical!
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I hope so. That'd be nice. If I'm 92, I'll be singing.
That's what keeps just making it there.
Yeah. But that's what keeps people alive and lucid is just constantly.
You always hear the stories of like a guy that like worked way longer than he should have, and then he finally retires, and then
they die. Yeah, 100%.
They just rot like a banana.
Yeah, they say that you need to have something to look forward to.
No, for sure. And I think it's nice to like. This is one of the few jobs that you can work until you die.
Yeah, exactly.
like, as long as your mind's engaged, you're like you're still on the vine.
Yeah,
the second 100%. You pluck yourself off the vine, it's like just the rotting process starts.
Yeah, but like people, like I'd put Mel Brooks in a movie in a second if he, you know, if he would do it. I doubt he would. But
I guarantee you, he would. Are you kidding me?
We tried to get him on a season of Meltdown because we're just like, well, Stuart Kornfeld knows Mel Brooks. You can ask him, and he was just like, he's not going to do it. He's lazy. He just wants to go to his office during the day and hang out with his grandkid.
I get that.
You know what though? And Carl, he hangs out with Carl. Like he and Carl hang out every night still.
Which is so crazy.
It really is. Yeah. But Preacher did just get renewed for season 3.
Uh-huh.
I'm so glad. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think that was going to be an issue. The show is fucking amazing.
No, thank God. Yeah. It's one of those things I think they had like internal deals to
work out.
But that's why it took a long time.
Yeah,
but
I think people
I'm so happy it did. Yeah, thank God.
People need to understand something about the entertainment business, which is when in doubt, lawyers. When people are like, exactly. "How come you don't
What's happening? Why is it taking so long?" Yeah. Yeah. There's some like lawyer shit happening. There was lawyer shit happening. But it worked out. It's happening. They're like, I actually just got the first outline for the first episode.
That's
like,
great.
That show is so, I genuinely, and I don't have to say this, I really don't, you know, I'm not doing Talking Preacher at the moment. I wouldn't have brought it up if I didn't feel this way. But, you know, watching, especially the transition between the first season and the second season and really seeing everyone lock in.
Yeah.
And you guys are dealing with some actually, despite the fact that the filter on the show is so surreal and almost cartoonish.
Yeah,
the performances are great, and there's really like heavy shit that everyone's dealing with.
Yeah, no, it's been thank you. It was a real, you know, I think the tone of to us of the show is like maybe like one of the more unique elements of it, and balancing comedy and horror and action and intense drama and kind of. These philosophical elements and things like that. And that's what the comic does so well more than anything is it's like, and I think that's why I loved it so much is it was everything. Like it felt like it included every single genre, which is why me and Evan were so drawn to it. And then, you know, the cast is just so incredible and they all ground it so much in like a heavy emotional reality. But yeah, I mean, between the first season and second season, we really tried to kind of up the ante, and we realized like we took some big swings and they seem to work, so what if we just try to take more big swings? And now I think as we go into the third season, there's probably like another evolution that the show can take, I think, to kind of balance, to kind of make it even a stranger mix of things.
I mean, on paper, it's a rough show to try to figure out because you're asking a lot of the audience to go like, okay, there's this guy and he's sort of possessed by this creature, and there's a battle with heaven, and there's a vampire, and there's an outlaw, and there's a dead killer, you know?
Yeah.
So there's so many elements, but I thought the show really focused in season two. So are you and Evan writing the next season?
No, Sam Catlin does all of it.
Sam does all of the writing.
We just talk to him a lot.
Right.
And complain to him a lot, basically, about... but we have a very good dynamic, and... we're very open about, and so is he, about look, and that's one of the cool things about a TV show, which we haven't experienced in movies, is you can look back at it and think, like, how could we improve this? Like, not even with the implication of, like, we made mistakes or why did we do this? It's more just like, we did it. We all like it. What can we do differently? What else could we do? How could it be even better? You know? And we listen to the cast obviously has a lot of thoughts on that too. So, and their perspective on the character evolves. And so that is something we take into consideration as well. And, it's interesting. I mean, we've never, you know, we've been making movies a long time, but Preacher's our first TV show that we've been like a big part of, and now it's going into the third season, and it's really like it's completely unlike anything we've ever worked on. Like TV is a very different beast, and both the length that it goes on for it's incredible how you can kind of evolve with it. But directorially, it's been amazing because. It's really just allowed us to try to, I think, again, the tone of the show is kind of the most specific thing. And it's, I think, allowed me and Evan to try things, take really big swings, but also try to balance them in a way that it hopefully feels like a cohesive like piece in some capacity, which has been the most fun for us, I think, of a lot of things we've worked on in a really long time. Yes.
I have this idea. I've been seeing a lot of series lately where I go, oh, that was like 10 episodes that really could have been 6 episodes.
Yeah.
And then you just realize like we're kind of in this weird space between filmmaking and then serialized television.
Yeah.
And what's kind of the right amount. So what are some of the challenges for keeping – because obviously I know how hard it is to make things, and so I'm very forgiving when I go, well, you know, a couple episodes are just going to be like
filler. Yeah.
They're just going to be a little filler. So like how do you kind of keep the tentpole action pieces going in each episode to drive each episode and avoid that?
I mean, we would just, again, they were the ones, the writers but like me and Evan pushed very hard for making it feel like it was more than you expected. Like we were saying, we said a lot, like it should feel like 13 episodes crammed into 10,
right,
or 15 episodes crammed into 13 or whatever that equation is, rather than the opposite. It should feel, if anything, that you're like surprised at the pace things are unfolding, rather than, you know, disappointed that the pace things are unfolding. And it felt like to us the first season maybe was a little measured in how it was doling things out, and so we thought with the second season maybe we could kind of accelerate that a little bit and introduce a lot quickly, so again, just so it didn't feel like the same, because that was also just something that we talked a lot about, is like we can change it, so maybe we should make little
changes. Sam Catlin's great too. Every time he's been on the show, he just seems like a cool guy.
He's a cool guy. He's got a lot of sick things going on in his head.
How do you and Evan write? Do you write together or do you write in shared Google Docs?
We only write together. Like
you actually physically have to be together to write.
Like we try to do it sometimes, not like that. Super bad for a few years. He was like in college and I was in LA, so we'd write over the phone a lot, but like we never divide and conquer. Like we never say,
you get
like,
this scene, I'll get the next one.
Yeah, we never do that. Yeah. We never say like, you take a stab. Sometimes outlining we'll kind of pass back and forth and take little stabs on, but like it's never nearly as good as when we're actually just sitting in the room doing it together. And so we mostly write, just sitting at one computer together, writing. And it's probably why we haven't written a movie in 5 or 6 years, because we've been busy doing other things and it's really hard to do that. But the truth is we wanted to make a production company and it took a few years to do that. And because of that, by the nature, our time, a lot of it was spent producing and directing TV shows and things like that rather than actually writing. And now we kind of did that, so we're able for the first time in a while to go back and actually start writing again. Nice. Basically,
I think people would probably assume like, well, you can do whatever you want. Is that true, or do you find that even at this level, you still go, yeah, we can do this, but I really want to be able to do that, and we're just not there yet?
I mean, fortunately for us, the things that have drawn our attention have never been the things that are like prohibitively expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, we've always just tried to make the thing that is like the crazy thing that we think we probably shouldn't be making, but is actually the thing that like is entertaining us. Like there's no real strategy. Like we don't make, you know, you don't make The Disaster Artist in hope of getting to make a weird one day, if we do this well, we'll get to make a really weird movie. everyone is like the end game, you know. But that being said, we have a hard time getting our movies made still. Like these small movies are not, you know, I say small, we make movies between like $10 and $40 million,
right,
basically. They're not easy to get made. Like, some of them are, but not the ones you would think. And, like, a lot of them, like, when we go out with a movie, it's not, like, a guaranteed slam dunk by any stretch of the imagination. Like, the fact that we're trying to make movies, comedies for theaters instantly is, like, psychotic.
And, you know, people don't have to leave their house anymore, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I know, but we're trying.
We're just trying. And so it's hard, yeah. I mean, it's always hard to get them made, almost always hard to get them made, but everyone is, like, the one we want to be making. And, like, the ideas that were, like, we can't do that. That's too weird. Those are like the exact ones that we pursue because over the years we found like those are the ones that other people also like the most. Like
right.
It's not just us. Like those are the ones that also do well and get good reviews and stuff like that are the ones that for years were just like, this is so fucking crazy, but if we actually do this, it'll be fantastic, we think, you know? It's the ones where we're like, people might like this. Those are the ones that don't go as well.
Yeah, you never... I'm always suspect of ideas where I go, this is a slam dunk.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's something about those ideas that are just too inside your own... It's like it's an inside joke between you and yourself.
Yeah. Exactly. This will sell.
This is going to be huge. No.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm dumb.
None of our... Yeah, like almost none of our movies... have been like that.
was there one movie in particular where you were like, this one's gonna be huge, and it didn't pan out as well as you thought it was gonna?
I'm trying to think.
Because to me, I feel like all your movies, like...
I'm like, they're... It's...
They all do pretty well.
They do okay. Yeah, yeah. I haven't had, you know...
Struggling to find a failure.
I'm struggling to find a failure that I truly don't believe deserve to have been a failure in some capacity. I generally think the universe works itself out in some way.
Yeah, that's about right.
No, they were right about that one.
You guys were right about that.
Well, I remember, and I think... Well, the truth is, I'm almost always disappointed when our movies come out because, like, and I've learned over the years not to be, but... And I think when I was younger, I did not appreciate it as much as I should have. And now, when I have a movie that comes out and does well and is well received, I like make a very conscious like appreciate this. This is not something that happens all the time. Don't take this for granted by any means at all. But you never do. But I actually like I. You never know. I remember thinking like 50-50 might be a movie that was going to do really well, and it did. Like, and then looking back, it did pretty well for a cheap movie. But it was like in an era of like those Juno type movies, and part of me was like, oh, maybe it'll become one of those type movies. And I remember being very upset the weekend it came out, and it was very apparent it was not going to be one.
No one flocked to go see the cancer movie.
Exactly. And then again, you look back in retrospect, and I'm like, the fact that we made a cancer comedy at that time is fucking insane.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was in any way received by like a general public audience is like a miracle.
Yeah.
And I didn't appreciate that at the time.
But even since that movie came out, everything's changed so much, even just since that movie came out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But A24, which is distributing the movie, they're really good at this kind of like very point of view driven sort of artfully done. I mean, there's a specific aesthetic too, you know, like and they're not all the same. It's just when you see the A24 logo, go, oh yeah, this fits in with the overall story that they're telling.
It's like a good record label. It's like you're like, well, I don't know much about it, but I'm going to check it out because they're geniuses.
Yeah. It's incredible to see. Like we are like basically the reason we became producers was to help control the marketing of our movies because it became just very frustrating to make movies and then have no control over how they were presented. And so that was a lot of like the motivation between us wanting to make a production company in the first place, basically. And so A24 has been like mind-blowing. Like it truly is like a next level approach to marketing and to reaching people and to creative swings and interesting ways of getting the movie out there. And it's so well thought out and well articulated. Like it's been really like a marvel to watch, and it's made my life very easy, which is nice.
Because my wife said to me, she was like, oh, I saw the trailer for Disaster Artist, it looks hilarious. And I go, yeah, but you haven't seen The Room yet. And she goes, oh, she didn't know what The Room was.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's good then. To see the trailer and not have anything.
She thought it looked hilarious. And I go, yeah, but you need to understand how many levels deep this goes.
Yeah.
So I showed her. So we watched the trailer together, and it was the scene where Franco comes out and he's doing the line about, I didn't hit her.
Yeah.
Oh, and so I showed her. I showed her a clip of that thing. I'm like, this is the movie that came from.
Yeah.
And she was totally blown away by it.
No, yeah, it's that was a huge conversation we had and it's great that that is the case because we very much wanted to make a movie that was you know, accessible to people who had never heard of The Room. And we know that was like a very niche group of people who are the last people we need to market to, because they'll fucking probably come to this movie anyway. And if anything, it's making it a universal idea and making it seem like something, or not seem like something, because it is that, but making sure people understand it's something that you don't have to be some like fucking comedy hipster to understand. You just have to be someone who's felt like they should be in a better position than they are in, or who's had some dream that seems out of reach that they want to pursue in some way, you know, because the themes are very universal. And then on top of that, it's just a very like entertaining, funny, heartfelt movie that, you know, Franco put a lot of himself into. But yeah, I mean, the fact that they were able to do that. And with the movie itself, we put a lot of thought into that. That's why J.J. Abrams is in the first 30 seconds. Because we're just like, if you understand he likes this movie, then you don't think, like, then you get culturally among filmmakers, it's something that is, you know, it's not just a very narrow thing. It's something that appeals to a lot of people, and that even if you, it's why there's like the most random collection of people in the opening 30 seconds of the movie. It was almost like they were handpicked to like any human will relate to one of these.
That's their way in.
And when you see they like this movie, you then will become invested in the success of it.
Well, it's you know, like a lot of people, like I had just started figuring out about Ed Wood before like Tim Burton's Ed Wood came out, and you know, they made like that was a huge studio movie off of a, like at the time was a very obscure, you know, it was pre-internet really, of just like a director that just made movies that were terrible.
Of course, yeah. We referenced Ed Wood a lot as we were kind of putting the movie together, and that is like I love that movie, and I'd never seen any of Ed Wood's movies before I saw that movie.
Yeah,
and it like I'd never seen one second of it, and it like completely blew my mind. And Boogie Nights is another movie we talked about a lot, in that they just cared so much.
They cared so much.
And it's so stupid that they cared so much, but it made you care, and you cared about them, and so you cared. And that, and like to us, that was like the key of the movie. And the other thing we talked the most about is like why people like the movie. Like we didn't want to make a movie that was just like clowning this guy. That was just like, fuck this idiot. He made a bunch of pieces of shit. Like it was more like, of all the bad movies, why is this the one that has been deemed the one that we are making a movie about?
Yeah,
like we couldn't knock its quality too much because it made it what we were doing seem pointless, because we're like, we're here. We're putting a lot of thought and energy and time into making a movie about this movie. There must be something good about it, because of all the bad movies, you know, we're not making like the fucking, you know, that like Commander Space, whatever, the one with Freddie Prinze Jr. and Matthew Lillard. Like, we're not making a movie about the making of that movie. Like, there's a lot of pieces of shit movies that we were not spending a lot of time thinking about. So that was something that we really, you know, put a lot of energy into discussing, was like, why are we drawn to this movie?
Yeah, like, that's a huge thing, though, with like bad movies. It's like, you know, Plan 9 is not a well done movie, but there's something to it that people keep on going back to.
I think it has a lot to do with, like, when you see a movie that's not good because it was either lazy or they were trying, it's like, the studio was trying to market to a certain thing, or everyone just, but when you see like Ed Wood or you watch The Room, or it's, I think there's a meta conversation that's happening with the audience, where the audience is understanding the humanity of this thing, where they go, it's like looking at a child's drawing and it doesn't make sense to you, but you know there's a whole fucking universe of stories going on in that kid's head.
Yeah.
And so you relate to it in the sense of like, well, I know what it's like to really care about something that maybe not everyone else understands. And you can see the way it's played out. I feel like I have a guess that James Franco probably weirdly understands Tommy Wiseau.
Very much so. And he's talked a lot about it. Like, James, you know, has been very misunderstood. He's been very pure in his desire to express themselves in ways that a lot of people just, like, have kind of told him, like, don't do that. Yeah. <You know?
laughs> Don't be an artist.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why are you doing that? Like,
yeah.
And it's all just out of this desire to kind of put himself out there and express himself and have people understand, you know, his creative sensibility, you know? And so he totally got it and, like, heavily related to Tommy. And it was one of, like, the most meta, you know, we made a movie where we play ourselves, and this was more meta than that, I think. Like, it was one of, it was like, the, there was these moments, because also he directed the movie in character, and I would venture to say never in the history of Hollywood filmmaking has an actor directed the movie they were starring in while staying in character as the person they are playing in the movie, which was just fucking weird. On top of that, in the movie, he's directing a movie. So there are scenes where he's acting like he's directing a movie in character, while in the movie, in character, he is also directing a movie, which is also fucking weird. And so it was like, and then, and knowing James and his desire to, like, do these things that are kind of commenting on themselves, and it's something we've talked a lot about over the years, and, you know, he was one of the first people we told the idea to this in the end to, and he was so enthusiastic about it and passionate about it that, like, it's so much just in his wheelhouse, these, like, ideas that almost, you know, start eating their own tail and become this, like, weird, cyclical, meta, like, thing that, and so, yeah, I mean, it, there was these moments where I was standing on set where I was just like, this is the most James Franco shit we could possibly be doing.
Like, but when something's going
more, yeah.
But when something is that far out there, when you're making it, you know, are you watching going, I think this is working, I hope this cuts together, you know, like it, or do you know when it's happening that it's,
you never know, honestly. But it felt like it was working, and it felt like the emotional story was clear enough that it could support all this other weird shit. And that was something that, like, you know, me and Evan were on set, like, throughout the whole filming. And also because, like, we know, I know it's not easy to act in scenes and direct. And it is, you want people there to kind of help you and guide you. And when I'm acting, you know, I, in the scenes, even while we were filming the interview and this is the end, like, Franco would help me a lot with my performance and was not shy about sharing his opinions on that. And so it was because we have that environment established, it was something me and Evan were constantly monitoring and imploring in Franco, is like, make sure in every scene we have, like, a very emotionally grounded moment where Tommy's not just so fucking weird that you're like, who is this guy? And that you feel bad for him, and you get that he's sad and not just weird and not just malicious. I remember it was like sad Tommy moments. We would always be like, we need more sad Tommy moments.
Did you hang out with him at all?
Yeah.
Because he seems one of my best friends, April, is obsessed with The Room to the extent that she's seen him speak numerous times.
Yeah.
And she's like, it's weird. He won't really talk about how old he is. He won't really talk about where he's from. About his past. He won't, like, there's just a lot of weird
mystery.
There's a lot of weird mystery. And is that part of who he is, or is that part of a you know, like, part of, like, is he aware of it? And I guess I would ask the same question about James Franco. Is James Franco aware of the character of James Franco? Like, when you're talking to him, are you like, wait, are we talking, or are you doing an art piece right now?
James Franco's very aware of the character of James Franco. I don't, with Tommy, it's like, at the premiere, it's endlessly fucking fascinating to me. Like, at the premiere last night, I was just looking at him being like, this guy's, like, at the premiere of a movie we made about the making of his movie, which, and this movie's being very well received. His movie was not well received, but he got famous enough that we all made this movie about him for the complete opposite reason that he wanted us to make the movie. But here he is at this thing where we expose the fact in our movie that he did not make the movie he was trying to make, but he's still here at this thing pretending that he made the movie that he was trying to make. It's so fucking weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of levels to it.
Well, it makes it, it really sort of challenges the idea of, like, what is success?
Yeah.
Like, does that, you know, it didn't necessarily succeed the way
he wanted to.
Or did it?
Yeah.
Because...
Well, that's what I was also looking at him last night, being like, it almost seemed as though he always knew this was going to happen. Like, he almost doesn't seem surprised.
Yeah. Like, it's like, of course this is happening.
It's almost like, of course, and it should have happened 5 years ago. It's also, like, kind of...
The vision board had this happening in 2009. Like,
so that's the other weird thing is, like... You feel as though he's like, of course we're at movie about making of my movie. Like, what else would you do?
Yeah,
like, this is what you do. They make movies about the making of the greatest movie. And it almost revalidates his original goal in some ways, you know? It's so fucking strange. It's like, and it continues to unfold in a fascinating way, even as the movie is being released.
And he just got a new movie out.
Yeah.
Like, too. And then, like, it played at Beyond Fest, and I didn't go that night, but everyone's like, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I know. Which is bad.
Yeah.
It's bad for his brand.
The worst.
It's Dan Brand, man.
It's the last thing he should be doing is making good movies.
But it's sort of this interesting, it's this interesting thing that's happening with art now. Now, especially with the internet, of just like how it evolves, it's sort of like, you know, the room is almost like,
it's like a meme.
It's a meme. It's like the first, it's like if someone made like a really bad MS Paint dinosaur, and then someone like Alex Ross like painted the dinosaur, like what that would look like. And so just seeing the evolution of expression and seeing it pass through hands, it does kind of make you go, okay. Is it a great movie? No. But is it a great movie? Yes.
Yeah.
Because it inspired all these people, and so it's artistic.
Yeah, there is something great about it. And that is like the thing that like I was one of the most vocal cheerleaders of as we were, again, writing the movie and putting it together, was like, the thing we cannot lose sight of is we are making a fucking movie about this movie. Like, we can't pretend it just sucks, because it doesn't. We wouldn't be doing this if it did.
Yeah.
We are ignoring reality if we just pretend it's bad, because it's not. It's not what he wanted it to be, but it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's bad, but it's not but it's not in and of itself not worthy of enjoyment, and not not endlessly captivating and entertaining in ways that things that are far more praised are not, you know.
But you can't approach something like this with cynicism. You have to you have to celebrate it and enjoy it. Like, there was, I was reading that Mel Brooks book about Young Frankenstein, and he's like, you can't, you have to be a fan of a thing you're parodying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, you can't just come at it going, making fun of it, because it's like, isn't this shitty? Because then everyone's going to be like, yeah, it's shitty. So why do you care if it's shitty?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that with this was like, it was the easiest hole to keep, to fall into over and over and over, was to just make fun of it and to just be like, look, it sucks. Like, this guy made a shitty movie. But yeah, the thing that, but did he? I don't know. That's the thing. Why have I seen it 10 times if it's so shitty? Like,
did it end
I just
up,
don't know.
Is there some sort of a figure of, like, how much did The Room gross? Because it ran...
It's in profits.
Yeah, because
he does not release that information.
He doesn't release that information.
No. But he is
the still, Netflix of humans.
He is still... Yeah, exactly. He's still the only way to get it. Like...
Yeah.
It's unavailable. Like, you can't order it from anywhere, but
you have to go to like a con and get it
from
him.
God damn it, he's a fucking genius.
And now he's got like ties and belts and clothes and yeah.
Well, now he didn't release it in tandem with
they are doing screenings and stuff like that, but it's not like, it's not, he's
yeah,
he's very proprietary over it.
Was he happy with how this one came out?
Yes, he said he was 99.9%
on his own Rotten Tomatoes side.
He's changed his answer a few times on what the 0.1% is, jeez, which just demonstrates his weird ability to reframe reality. Because he first saw it at South by Southwest, and it was crazy because he had not seen the movie. No one had really seen the movie. We had done like very small screenings. And then we were, and it wasn't done, and we were premiering it at South by Southwest, and Tommy was there. And there was going to be like a Q&A after, and the whole debate was like, do we invite him up for the Q&A?
Oh, he showed up.
Yeah,
because
he was there. We knew he was going to be, we weren't 100% sure he was going to come because he's a wild card in general. So he showed up.
Sounds like you're at a zoo where you're like, we don't know if Simba's gonna come
exactly
out. But maybe
exactly right. And so he was there, and then we were like the whole time we're like, do we invite him up at the end? I don't know, because like he could have, we didn't know what he was gonna say. So like there was a chance he was just got up and be like, fuck this movie, these people ruined, like lied, none of this true, which would have just fucked the movie completely. Because no one wants to see a true story that the guy it's about is walking around saying it's not fucking true.
Unless it's him.
Unless
maybe that would have been the best press.
So the movie ended and we all go up there, and it was clear that it played very well, which was nice. And there was a moment where someone in the audience like started to notice that Tommy was there, basically. And you could see people starting to like it kind of spread throughout the theater a little bit. And then the end of this movie is like literally a theater full of people chanting Tommy's name and inspiring him to get up and go on stage. And that's exactly what happened. Is the theater started chanting Tommy, Tommy, and you could see he didn't want to get up, which we thought was because he didn't like the movie, and we were like, fuck, what the f-? Now they're like making him come down here and he's gonna talk shit about us. And then he came down and everyone was going crazy, and he just kind of waved and didn't say anything. But then afterwards he told us that he loved the movie 99.9%. He was very shy. He's like very shy at times.
But what are the odds that that one of these days he's just going to go, actually, my name is Chad Turner.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
From Des Moines.
Like, zero.
So you buy into.
Yes.
What is your working theory on him? Do you have a theory on him and what his story might be?
I think he's Eastern European. I think... I don't know. Honestly, beyond that, that's all I got.
Isn't that crazy? You made a movie about a guy that you actually don't really know that much about.
Yeah.
No. Except for just the thing he made.
And I think... I don't know where... I actually don't know where his money came from. It could have been... I know it wasn't this like jean shit, like he was selling like counterfeit jeans or some shit like that. That's where he says it's from. I know it's not from that, because I don't think you make millions and millions of dollars doing that.
But is it something, do you think he inherited, or is it some like weird like stolen Hitler art? Or like,
yeah, exactly.
Something really
it's
shady?
Like a Klimt painting. Yeah, I don't know. No, I have no idea. I don't know if he has any family. So I honestly have no. We've talked about it endlessly. Jeez. I have no idea. We have no. We've like, yeah, maybe he inherited it. That's like a good running theory, is that he inherited it. Maybe someone gave it to him.
Maybe he's like Banksy. He's a collective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah,
there's
like
he's nine Tommy guys.
Yeah. No, I really don't know. I don't know how old he is. And I assume he's from Eastern Europe. That's the best I got on that one. Yeah.
And did you guys had to, because there was a book that inspired the movie, but then did you, were you legally required to deal with him at all? Or did you just deal with him to just kind of get more background for the movie?
We were, because we needed to license the movie itself.
Gotcha.
And the music from the movie and the score of the movie.
Did you have to pitch him? Did you have to go sit in front of him and go, here's what we want to do?
Franco early on had a call with Greg and Tommy. Greg and Tommy are still very good friends, though. So it wasn't, it wasn't like a big challenge to overcome. But I think Tommy was excited that Franco was going to direct the movie, but he wanted Johnny Depp to play him. And then Frank was like, I don't think we'll get Johnny Depp. And he's like, okay, maybe you could do it then.
Well, he did such a great job, though. He's so sincere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Franco's good. We were just talking about like his greatest skill as an actor is making like really weird characters very likable.
Yeah, and on paper he's too strikingly handsome to be.
Yeah.
It's almost like you like part of the magic, part of the prestige of James Franco was like you're too attractive to have that much depth.
You're too
attractive to be that arty, which I know is a very narrow-minded thing to say, but just when you sort of look at the archetype of what you're normally used to, what we're normally presented with, and I think that's why he's so confounding to people, because it's like, wait a minute, you have a tremendous amount of depth for someone that really could just be a leading man if you wanted to.
And he also doesn't take himself like too seriously. Like, he's willing to do, like, there is very few people that are actually as funny as he is that are also as good an actor as he is.
Yeah.
Like, there's almost nobody like it that I've seen. You know, there are people who are funny and, like, you know, or who are good at committing to a character, but to be able to be in it enough to be, because in order to improvise great comedy, you kind of have to have one foot outside of it a little bit. Like, it's hard. I've seen it's hard for actors who are the type of actor who are so fully committed to something. It's hard for them to improvise comedy sometimes because you have to be a little looking at it from the outside, having some element of awareness of, like, what would an audience laugh at this moment?
Yeah. Right.
Not just what would I do truthfully in this moment, in order to make, like, jokes, you know?
Right.
Great jokes. And Franco is, I mean, maybe the only person I've ever worked with who, like, is able to give the performance of an actor that is 100% committed, but is also has, like, one toe outside of it enough to look in and be able to come up with, like, comedic jokes, you know?
Within,
and, like,
the character.
Within the character. It's really not something that a lot of people can do.
So are you guys working? You're doing all the press for this. I know this comes out. Is it December 1st? Does Disaster Artist come out December 1st?
I think
1st?
8th or 1st. I can't remember.
Honestly. I think it's the 1st.
Maybe it's the 1st. Maybe it's limited the 1st and then wide the 8th. There you go.
I'll tell you
I've
exactly.
I've never had a platform release. I don't know how they do it.
It says it's in theaters December 1st.
There you go.
Yeah. So there you go. And then does it come out on VOD right at, like, pretty soon after that?
No.
No, it's like you're going to do a big run.
It's like a real movie in theaters, yeah.
But they are doing that now. Like, they are simultaneously releasing VOD and theatrical releases.
They are.
Yeah.
We felt very strongly that because it's a movie about a guy who made a movie and put it in theaters, and the climax of the movie is in a theater, and so much of it is geared towards these guys' dreams of seeing themselves in the big screen, that it should be a movie that you have the opportunity to see in a movie theater, and that be its, hopefully, the main way people who are excited to see it ingest it, because we thought that was just the best way to watch it. And so it's a very personal decision, I think. We just produced a movie for Netflix, and the people who made that movie, the directors and the writers and stars, were all 100% comfortable with it. So, and then we are producing other movies where the writers and directors and stars are like, no, we want this to be in theaters. So it really is like a case-by-case thing, and really is like a very personal thing. There's not even a lot of logic to it, I find sometimes. Some people are just like, I don't mind, or I want this, or I don't want this. Yeah. And this was a movie that, for whatever reason, we all were like, it should be in theaters.
Isn't that crazy, though, when you work for Netflix, though? And I think this could either be good or bad. Maybe it's kind of interesting as an artist because you can't get hung up on stuff. You'll probably never know how it does.
Never, yeah, it's weird.
They'll never tell you how it does. So you kind of just go, oh, we made this thing.
It's weird.
And normally, because we have so few real benchmarks for really understanding, like, are we being successful? Which sort of ties back to the Wiseau thing. Are we being successful? I guess enough people saw this. It made X number of dollars. And then this. But with Netflix, it's like, well, we made it. I guess that's just going to have to be good enough.
It's kind of nice. I mean, I've talked to people about, you know, weighing the pros and cons of making movies for Netflix. And I think it's a pro or a con. Like, when I make movies, you're basically worried about two things. Is it going to get good reviews? And is it going to make money? And when you make a movie for Netflix, you only are worried about one thing. Is it going to get good reviews? Because you're never going to learn about the other thing. And so, in a way, I guess that's nice that you are removing one of the two things to worry about. But at the same time, you're also removing one of the two rewards of your efforts, you know? Yeah. And if you make a movie in theaters that does really well, you are capturing, you know, it's very traditional, but for me, just because I grew up watching movies and going to theaters, like there's something about that as it relates to how I personally like to express myself that I want my movies to be in theaters. The ones that I'm writing and directing at this moment, you know, but at the same time, I 100% understand not wanting that or just being or that being your only option, which I very much am sympathetic to.
Are you coming to pull him away this second?
Cool. And then we just wasted him there by asking.
How about just give us 3 minutes to wrap to just give us 3 minutes to like glide this in for a landing.
They should show the Disaster Artist at the Sunset Five in perpetuity. They should just always have it
they
be playing there.
Yeah. That'd be amazing.
Well, just
be
in double two theaters should be the always. Room.
Yeah, the room and the Disaster Artist
at the same time.
Which one? If someone has not seen The Room, do you recommend they see The Room first and then Disaster Artist, or the other way around?
I really don't know. It's a good question. I was thinking about it. It might be more. It kind of works either way. If you've seen The Room, you will definitely want to see the movie. If you haven't seen The Room, you'll come out of The Disaster Artist and really want to see it. But I've shown the movie to a lot of people who haven't seen it, and we almost geared it more in a way towards people who hadn't seen it because we knew that was the majority of people, you know? And so if we were going to err on any side, it was more erring on the side of trying to make it for people who had no idea what it was. And part of me thinks it's almost more gratifying in a way if you don't know the result completely.
Right.
Because then there is an element of mystery as to exactly what's going to happen, you know, and exactly how it'll play out. And I feel like if you know, then you know. It's not as surprising in some ways, but it is just incredibly insightful to see. It almost like decodes the movie in a weird way. It's like all these things that seem like random nonsense, you start to realize, like, oh, there's a reason for it. Like, the reason he threw the bottle. The reason his pockets are full of stuff. The reason that, like, it's all actually very, like, it is very motivated, just in a way that's invisible without context.
And do you know if that was all true? Was some of it embellished, or do you know that, like, these were all the real things that happened?
It's largely true. I mean, there were some little things, but it's mostly based on what happened.
Yeah. And then lastly, because you're in the midst of a junket today, which I always feel, and I know you don't feel good either, so doing a junket when you kind of have a cold
is great. It's what you're hoping for. Yeah,
it's hard enough to focus at a junket when you're in perfect health.
Exactly. Yeah.
But then when your head's a little swimming, you're like, what did I just
what is
say
happening?
What did I just say? Did I say anything
crazy?
Are people gonna be upset about anything? But is there anything you're working on right now that you're super 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 excited about? I mean, are you working on 5-10 different things?
I'm filming a movie right now in Montreal with Charlize Theron, a romantic comedy, an R-rated romantic comedy directed
Fantastique.
By Jon Levine. I think it might, like, yeah, I was like, and it's like, it's kind of like a big romantic comedy movie, which they don't really make anymore. So that'll either be really good for us or really bad for us. But I'm very excited about it. We've been filming for a few weeks and it feels incredibly hilarious. So it's
good.
Exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. I think at this point, I don't know if you feel like when you finish a project, like, well, that was probably the last one. I don't know if we're going to do it again.
I never know.
But I think you'd probably have to have like 15 bombs in a row. At this point,
it'd have to be behavioral.
It would have to be behavioral. Yes. It would have to be behavioral. Let me just say, I love you so much. Please don't turn out to be
a
douchebag.
Very nice. 100%.
Please.
I can guarantee.
Every morning when I look at the news, I'm like, oh, Christ, who is it today?
No,
what monster's been unmasked?
I've been debating, like, putting out, like, a notice where you're just like, don't worry about me. I don't want to occupy attention in this moment, but just know that I'll be okay.
Actors are going to start putting out political cads like, hey, Seth Rogen, he's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't you worry.
Just remember, I'm still out there just
I dated
nice.
Seth Rogen in 1998, and he was a gem.
Exactly.
No, brought to you by the Citizens
fine.
For Seth Rogen.
Exactly. I'll be good.
Good. Thank you so much.
Thank
I appreciate
you. No,
that.
Thank you.
See you, Seth. Enjoy
you
your burrito.
Too. Appreciate it.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I have missed these Friday night dinners.
Welcome to Harvey Graw!
At these family dinners...
Gracious, everyone!
Dysfunction is served.
Wah! I can't have you all messing things up for my entire adult life.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we embarrass you?
Jump, jump, jump!
It's already better than I dared to dream.
They're extra.
Let the wild rumpus start!
Woo, 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 woo.
And they're embarrassing.
We know how hard it is to move on from the first girl that you ever slept with.
Not the first girl who I ever slept
with. Yeah, 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 right. You're a regular
lady killer.
I thought you said it was going to be boring here tonight.
No!
I really hope it would be.
But they couldn't love each other more.
Surprise! To mom and dad being totally normal.
Wow.
So, dinner next Friday, everyone?
Wouldn't miss for the world.
Dinner with the Parents, Season 1. Stream free only on Freevee.